Next case for argument is 22-2143 BCC UI Projects versus Secretary of the Army. Whenever you're ready, sir.
Okay. May it please the court, Patrick Kernan here on behalf of the appellant. The ASBCA decision below imposed overly restrictive requirements and inconsistent with this court's precedent in finding that there was no jurisdiction of the case before the court. We would ask the court to overturn that decision.
Didn't it just require that the contractor be the one that submit the claim?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, there were several facets to the decision. One of them was the issue of...
I know there's a bunch of other issues, but isn't that the fundamental issue, is that the individual that submitted and signed the claim was not authorized to submit it on behalf of the joint venture?
It's our position that the JV, and consistent with this court precedent, any member of the JV, unless there's explicit authority otherwise, could submit a claim on behalf of the JV.
Well, the agreement had identified a specific person who was authorized to sign the contract, sign solicitations, applicable amendments, and bind the entire joint venture. That sounds like that's the guy that's got the authority. And even if it doesn't explicitly talk about claims, when your guy tried to submit a claim, this guy came in and said, no, he can't.
Yeah.
So it's not very ambiguous about who gets to submit a claim. It's this guy, not your guy.
Well, if you look at the JV itself, it is ambiguous because it doesn't say who submits a claim.
But yes, but to the extent that's ambiguous, we have extrinsic evidence from this guy who's the authorization to enter into most of the contractual obligations saying, yeah, nobody else, it's me.
Yeah, but that was his representation at that point. But it was also a settlement between the parties where they authorized
the settlement was way too late, though, right? It was after this contract was done and over.
Well, I don't know what Your Honor, you mean by done and over. The contract was
done and over. Final payment had gone out.
No, that's what the contracting office kept saying. The final payment was made, but there was no release of claims on this, so they were still entitled to submit a claim. And that's the problem with the contracting officer's decision in this case, is that they were making representations to the contractor.
So did they submit a new claim that was authorized by the JV?
It relates back to the ones they originally submitted, Your Honor.
If we think it's too late, then that original claim was by an unauthorized person. You need that settlement agreement to ratify, right?
Well, our position is he had the authority to begin with, but the settlement agreement ratified. What was the purpose of submitting it to the contracting officer if there wasn't to ratify?
Is it your position that he had the authority in the first instance?
Any member of the JV, in the absence of explicit authority otherwise, had the authority to submit submit a claim. The JV did not say they did not have the authority to submit a claim.
Yes, they did. The guy that was authorizing the JV agreement to bind the JV said this guy doesn't have authority.
The JV did not address whether or not the claim could submit a claim.
Yes. But when it was asked who could submit a claim, the actual entity, they said, not this guy, only me.
They were never asked. The individual submitted an email saying that was not authorized. He represented that, and it was subsequently
So let's just assume you're wrong on that point. Your guy was not entitled to submit a claim. Where does that leave you in this case?
It leaves us with, we had a settlement agreement that was submitted to the contracting officer. There was no point to submit it to the contracting officer if they weren't trying to authorize the initial claim.
Is that what it said? I thought it just said, we'll split the profits. It didn't say this claim is now ratified and certified by the JV, did it?
It said they had the authorization to submit a claim, and the purpose of submitting it to the contract.
Can you point that to me in the appendix, the language?
Yeah. What is it?
275. That's what I'm looking at. I hope I'm looking at the right thing, but you're about to tell me.
Yes, Your Honor. In the second paragraph, it said second party covenants agrees that has submitted a claim for a contract and shall pay 50% of the proceeds paid by USACE for such settlement proposal to the first party. So they acknowledge the submission of the claim and they've agreed how it would be divided.
Assume we read this as retroactively authorizing the submission of a claim, and it doesn't really say that. It just acknowledges a claim was submitted, and if you get money, you're going to pay 50% to me. Isn't there still a problem with the timing of this?
Not if it was submitted to the contracting officer to ratify the initial submissions. I mean, what would be the point?
The contracting officer's position was that this was too late, that a claim could not have been submitted at this point.
Ratification
can't occur after the time for completion of claims has occurred. The original claim was defective. The ratification has to be a timely ratification so that the contracting officer still had the authority to act on the claim, not that it had the authority to act back then.
2 points on that. I don't think it was untimely, according to the facts. You're saying that the contract was closed out, but it was not closed out. There was no release of claim, so they still had authority to submit a claim. The contracting officer's interpretation on that is erroneous, and the contractor kept telling them that was erroneous. That they did not submit a release of claims. And the second point is...
I mean, the guy that didn't have the authority to submit the claim kept telling them that.
Everyone. There was a number of emails on that point.
Including the one from the guy identified in the contract that was authorized to do things?
He submitted the settlement paperwork, Your Honor. And the other point is that it's always correctable who submitted, you know, the validation of who submitted the claim. This court has held that it can be corrected by the contractor. So in this instance, they did do the settlement and they corrected who had authorization to submit the claim. And in that way, they did properly submit the claim with authorization.
Even accepting what you're saying is correct, you still got a timeliness problem, do you not? Because the last communication with the contracting officer was in 2016. And then you filed in 2021. So how do you account for the 5-year delay as being appropriate under the law?
Well, we filed within the 6-year statute of limitations of the claim arising. With respect to the 90-day, the 90-day requirement, our position is there was no final decision in this case. The contracting officer never issued a decision that advised the contractor of his appellate rights. Which is a requirement.
And when that happens, then the 90 days is out the window and you're into the 6-year statute.
Yes, Your Honor. That's the point to, you know, put the contractor on notice that he's got to file his claim, you know, so that the clock starts to go. And in this case, they were almost misleading to the contractor. The email said that, you know, as Your Honor said, this contract is closed out. That's the end of it. You know, so they didn't even tell them. They basically misled them.
What's misleading about that? I mean, we're not going to address your claim because the contract's done. If you wanted to challenge that timeless determination, why didn't you do it within the proper amount of time?
Well, the contractor wasn't told that he said it was done. I think the wording was in the email was, I consider this matter closed. Consider this matter closed doesn't advise him that he has an appellate right that the matter's closed. So it basically misled the contractor in that regard. Not only did he not advise him of his appellate rights, he actively misled them with his email. In the second, there's another email, he said the same thing. Consider this matter closed, final pay was made. So not only did he not tell him he had the right to appeal to the Court of Claims or ASPCA, he told him that the matter was closed. In this situation, we're dealing with a contractor that's in Afghanistan, foreign country. We're before the court talking about these confusing procedures, etc. And you're expecting him to interpret these somewhat misleading statements from the contracting officer, understand to him that he had these appellate rights to appeal to this court back here in Washington, D.C. with respect to the court's decision below, with regard to the submission of the claim, the court held below that the first letter, July 17th, 2014, was not a claim. And the reason they said that, it was not a sum certain. This court in August 22nd of 2023 ruled that the sum certain requirement is not a jurisdictional requirement. And that was before this decision was issued. So at a minimum, that issue needs to be returned to that court because they held that the sum certain with respect to that initial claim was jurisdictional, and therefore that initial letter was not a claim.
Did you make that argument in this case?
No, because our briefing was done around the January timeframe, and that decision
was still available to you, though.
Yeah.
I mean, just because you didn't think of it doesn't mean you can raise it after the fact.
What respect to that argument?
The some certain nothing.
We said it was a some certain. The first time that we were presented with
it. We didn't say in the alternative, if it's not considered a some certain, it's not jurisdictional, so it shouldn't have been dismissed for lack of jurisdiction. That argument was available to you, but you just didn't make it.
Well, I mean, the first time that it came up was in the decision of the ASBCA.
Because those people, I mean, it came up in our court because the people in that case made the argument. You didn't.
But no one was saying that it was inadequate, some certain, so that the case should be dismissed, so we would be arguing against ourselves to raise it before the ASBCA.
Well, you could have raised it to us, though.
We did raise that issue in our briefing to the before you that there was an adequate some certain in this matter.
Right. You want to hear from the other side?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry.
May it please the court. The board correctly dismissed this case because the joint venture that the government contracted with never submitted a valid claim.
What's wrong with his argument that the settlement agreement ratified the claim?
Well, a number of things. First, we don't think there was a claim there, but just to start with the idea of ratification. It's certainly true that you can come in and convert some prior correspondence to a claim. But the problem in this case is that never happened. If you look at Appendix 2600, I mean, this is a key page. You've got this exchange. Nobody's confused there. You've got this exchange on Appendix 2600 where after everything's done now the settlement agreement, as they call it, is done. You've got the consultant with lots of experience, including as a government contracting officer, the consultant working for the contractor saying...
I'm sorry, we're on 2600. Where should I look? There's more than one email here.
Right, so it's the first email and the second email on the top of the page. So the second from the top of the page, the last part of that email.
Hi, Frank.
Hi, Frank, right, and then specifically that last part of that sentence. We wish to proceed with the REA and or possibly convert it to a claim. Then you look at the response from the government contracting officer. Convert to a claim. REA has been responded to because the government had denied these REAs. So we don't have anyone confused here about, what's going on. We just have, for the next 5+ years after this exchange, nothing. There is no then, here's our claim certification now that the authority issue is worked out. There's just nothing for 5 years until all of a sudden in 2021, there's a notice of appeal with the board filed that claims that the government never responded to what we say is an REA. They call it a claim.
Do you take this little one-line email, convert to a claim, REA has been responded to be a final denial of a request for equitable adjustment?
No, that already had happened.
That had already happened.
This and they didn't argue.
Confirms that it happened.
It confirms that the REA had been denied. It confirms that both parties understood going on here.
And this is the contracting officer saying convert to a claim. What was that a direction to the contractor to do?
It's a direction to this consultant saying, if you want to proceed with this, the next step is you need to submit your claim certification. You need to ask for a final decision. You need to do what the CDA requires.
You need to ask an additional request for a final decision on what you said was an already final denial of the request for equitable adjustment?
It's not an additional request for final decision from our perspective, because although there's disagreement between the parties here, when we go look at the prior correspondence, we do not find a request for a final decision at all there. And to the contrary, what we see there is there was some discussion about there was misleading and that it's a contractor in Afghanistan who doesn't understand. That's not who this was exchanged with. If you go look at these REAs, they're on a letterhead of a consultant who used to work for the government as a contracting officer. And in those REAs, you do not have the CDA claim certification that was significant, for example, in Zafir. To the contrary, you have a person who is well-informed and sophisticated in government contracting submitting to a government contracting officer a document that cites, with the statutory reference, the REA certification, which is different than the CDA's claim certification.
So these REAs we are talking about, are these also the ones that were submitted by the unauthorized person?
Correct. There was never an REA.
And that was the basis for why the government rejected them.
One of the basis, yes.
Right. But, and so the problem is not just that the government rejected them for being unauthorized. Those could never be converted to a claim without a proper CDA certification because they weren't claims in the first place. And it's fuzzy, I know, between REA and claim, and probably Zafir made it a little bit fuzzier, but at least in Zafir, it said there was a certification, right?
Right, absolutely.
And your view is there is no certification of these REAs that could potentially transform what was titled an REA into a claim.
That's correct. There's only the REA certification. There was not the claim certification.
And so even if there was going to be ratification somehow, it's not really ratification. They have to submit something saying, here's our claim now, and here's the certification.
Right. Even if you were to say that what was submitted before was now somehow ratified, authorized retrospectively, that's not enough because what was submitted before not only was it denied, not a claim. But it wasn't a claim.
So this settlement agreement we looked at then, the problem with it is not so much, well, there's probably a lot of problems in your view, but even if we accept that it tried to ratify a claim, what it was ratifying was not a claim. And it couldn't retroactively make it a claim without a CDA certification and the like.
Correct. And further to that point, it's never possible to put the government on the clock retrospectively. You need some further thing. There's interest starts from the date of the claim. The government's on the clock for its final decision. You need, so even if you come back with some very short one-page thing that takes prior correspondence, says now it's claim, you need something further to turn it into a claim, and that's what never happened here. That's why I was pointing the court to that page, Appendix 2600.
Did the board here find that this settlement agreement, the February 7th, 2016 settlement agreement, was not, in fact, a ratification of authority to have made the earlier filings made only by the Z company? I thought it did.
The board did determine. The board did determine on Appendix 14, there's a heading that says, the quote, settlement did not retroactively provide Mr. Sutherland, that was the consultant working for the contractor, authority to submit the claims. And then further on Appendix 15, the board is observing that the appellant did not even argue below that those emails had the effect of perfecting a claim. So after the settlement, there was email exchange between the government and the contractor. And that argument wasn't made, even that those emails then had the effect of now, in essence, being the claim, perfecting the claim, converting it to a claim. So that argument wasn't even made. So the board's...
Are both of those determinations that we owe deference to, because the first is factual and the second is, I don't know, a forfeiture or something point?
Well, the first one, just to make sure...
That the February 7th, 2016 settlement agreement did not, in fact, purport to grant retrospective authorization to the earlier filings.
Yeah, on deference, I think it would depend on how you interpret
that. Is that a factual determination?
Not necessarily. If it's legal interpretation of a contract, a settlement agreement, I wouldn't say that's factual. If the court were to see more in that finding than just straight interpretation of a contract, perhaps. I mean, there certainly was material put before the court. But I think the board there was just reading the document on its face, and it doesn't really say what the appellant wants it to say as far as retroactive. It's acknowledging something that apparently they thought happened that really did not ever happen as far as submission of a claim before. And so that's what that paragraph 2 in that settlement agreement, it doesn't now say, okay, now we agree you can submit a claim, or that now we agree that an authorized claim was submitted in the past. It doesn't actually say that. It seems to be a misunderstanding between the two of them.
Well, it could be the way I think it was described earlier. I think Judge Hughes said, we recognize that there was a claim filed, and this is the percent that we've agreed we get, and each of the two venturers get without doing anything more than that.
So the language specifically on Appendix 275 in that settlement agreement is the second party covenants and agrees that it has submitted a claim. Now, the second party
is the Z company.
Yes, yeah. But it was never able to do that. So there's a little bit of a disconnect there between...
But it just says, we agreed that one of us submitted a claim. That doesn't say that we agree that it was properly submitted on our behalf.
Absolutely not. Right. And even then submitting that agreement to the government now, if you're the government, you're receiving this information and you're thinking, I've already denied what was submitted to me.
I don't understand how it would work, but first of all, it seems like there's a factual mistake in that settlement agreement, which was that a claim was submitted. Your view is no claim was CDA claim was submitted because there was no certification. Let's just assume there actually had been a certification by an unauthorized person. What would happen then with this language? How can somebody, because the government's required to respond to a claim within a certain amount of time, right?
Yes.
Or it's deemed denied, and then they have to bring a challenge to that. I don't understand what would happen to this later ratification if it somehow was a claim before and the government had mistakenly said it's not a claim.
They still would have needed to take a further step, because even if they suppose that what they submitted the first time had the CDA claim certification but not from somebody who had authority to provide it, now they decide, okay, we've worked it out, we're going to split it 50-50, what's next? Just giving the government, okay, we've worked it out, and this person says they submitted it, that doesn't do it. You need, this court has recognized the anti-fraud purposes of the certification. You need to actually give the government a certification that is authorized when provided, and that certainly never happened.
The board below said that even assuming, so this is what I'm a little unclear of, even assuming that a valid claim was submitted, it was okay because it was unequivocally denied more than 90 days prior to this appeal. But under that assumption, I think your friend is arguing, well, it wasn't unequivocally denied because they didn't provide appeal rights. So you can't kind of just convert it and say, even if it was okay because they were under the clock of 90 days.
Even if they were able to establish that there was a defect for lack of appeal rights, they would have to show prejudice to have it make any difference and stop the running of the clock to file and potentially make it timely. And so the board went through how there was no evidence that the board found credible of any prejudice. And the declaration that was submitted in support of that, the board found to just be not true, the statements made in there, to the point that it had no evidentiary value.
If one is construing what it is is being done and there is no notice of appeal rights, can't the contractor fairly assume, well, this means it's not a final denial because there's no notice of appeal rights?
Is that
a fair assumption?
So there wasn't a contracting officer's final decision here. That's why there was no appeal rights. And the reason there wasn't a contracting officer's final decision is because these parties who were communicating with each other and spoke the same language, the consultant with the contracting officer, They understood each other that no request for a final decision had been made. So as we point out, the only reason the appeal rights are not there, the only reason it wasn't styled as a contracting officer's final decision, is because the alleged claims weren't styled as claims. And so you can't have it both ways. I mean, there's no question.
No, I know, but I'm just going to the boards looking at it, wanting to have it both ways, and saying even if there was a final denial, they were under the 90-day clock and not under the 6-year clock.
I don't think it's the board that wants to have it both ways. I think it's the appellant here. So the point is, if that's a claim, if that document is a claim and it was authorized and all that, if that's a claim...
Which document?
The second REA, document at Appendix 197. That's the one they claim is their claim. But the point is, if that's a claim, it was denied. So you get 90 days from when your claim is denied. So we're saying there was no claim here. But even if there was, it wasn't appealed within 90 days of the denial of that document. So there's three, from our perspective, there's three problems here where even one is too many. There's the lack of authority. There's that these documents just were not claims. They were not requesting that the government provide a final decision to start the CDA. And even if they were, they were promptly and unequivocally denied. And so the request of the board, that this court affirm.
I just want to be clear. When do you think the two REA requests were denied?
So the first one.
September 15th, 2014.
That's right, on Appendix 195.
Right, and when's the second one?
The second one is denied Appendix 2513 on
December 16th, 2015.
That's right.
Right, and then the settlement agreement comes in within 90 days. So that if that one is still somehow live, right, it comes in February 7th, 2016. That's 50 days or so.
Yeah, I don't understand the significance of the settlement agreement between those parties.
Well, there was a conversation way back at the beginning of this argument about whether the settlement agreement was kind of too late. Suppose it was a ratification and a retroactive ratification. The clock was still available on the assumption that December 16th, 2015 decision was a denial of a claim.
Well, but the 90 days, these are separate things, I think. The 90 days is from the denial to the board.
That's right.
So whether after the REA denial or claim denial allegedly to the parties working things out is 90 days, I don't see the significance there. I mean, certainly once they worked it out, they were within the 6 years when they could have submitted their claim, and then there would have been 90 days from the denial to where they could go to the board. But factually, you're right. Yes, the settlement agreement, Appendix 275, was within, it was February 7th. The denial of the second REA was December 6th.
The board speaks of, this is the kind of in the alternative, after the board says there was a claim, namely the second REA was denied December 17th, 2015, and says, but no appeal was filed within 90 days of that. And I'm trying to understand your primary position, maybe based on that email, is that that's just wasn't a claim, so there no clock was ever running. No clock to get to the board. No 90-day clock was ever running. There just wasn't the prerequisite, namely a final denial of a CDA claim or 90 days, is it? No, 120 days of inaction on a claim, which then permits the contractor to say it's deemed denied. Doesn't require the contractor to. The contractor can sit there forever, right, and not be mandated to deem it a denial.
Right. Our primary position, we disagree with the board a little bit. We say there was never a valid claim. So none of those clocks started. But we totally agree with the board on the principle basis of the board.
Then if we thought that the settlement agreement was a valid retroactive ratification of at least the second claim, or the second request for equitable adjustment, where does that
leave us?
So if you thought that them entering into their settlement agreement and then giving the government a copy
That's
of their
right.
settlement agreement
a few days
had
later,
the
right.
effect of submitting a certified claim valid under the CDA, then I suppose you would then decide whether you think that the subsequent emails where the government is making clear, I've already denied this, is a final decision such that the clock started, or you decide that, well, the government didn't respond. There was a failure to respond, even the government saying, I've denied this, this is close. In which case, yeah, there'd be no clock. They could come in 100 years if that was what the court decided. Obviously, we think that's wrong.
Just briefly, I think I ran over on the initial. With respect to the claims, as the court identified, there was the court, ASPCA did decide that there was a valid claim with the letter, the second letter that was submitted on May 27, 2015. So there had to have been a valid final decision. In this case, there was never a valid final decision. Counsel even admitted that initially, that there was never a valid final decision. It was just a bunch of emails. There was no rights given to the contracting officer. There was no way for them to know about the appeal rights. With the issue with regard to prejudice.
The business of prejudice, as I understand it, comes up when there is a final decision, but it omits a regulatory and maybe even statutorily required notice of appeal rights. But that doesn't even come up if there just never was a final decision.
That's correct. And so... And there is a limit on this, as everyone is well aware. There's a 6-year statute of limitation.
Yes.
The government has the ability to give them the 90 days and move everybody forward, but they never did that in this case. With respect to the first claim, in this case, we're saying there wasn't a valid certification. This court's decision in ECC International indicates that that was a valid claim, because the only reason the court found below that it wasn't a valid claim was that it didn't have a sum certain. And we know that's not a jurisdictional requirement. It did have a net amount identified, and it did.
This is the arithmetic error.
Yeah, the arithmetic error. And that was the July 17, 2014 letter. Thank you, Your Honor. No further questions.
We thank both sides. The case is submitted. That concludes our proceedings for this morning.